Hi, everyone. We are back again this week with another wonderful guest. This week, I am here with the lovely Roz McElwee. I was just complimenting her on her name. It's a mouthful. The full version of Roz is?
Rosamond.
Rosamond. I love it.
Thank
so that's
you.
The name you got called when you were in trouble.
Yeah.
Rosamond.
Yeah.
I love it. But you go by Roz.
I go by Roz, yeah.
Okay. And Roz, you're from Laois.
I'm from Laois, yeah. I grew up in Mount Mallock, outside Mount Mallock, and I'm now back in Laois after studies and Dublin. And so I'm back in Kilnard in Laois.
Touring around the place.
Yeah.
You're back to your roots.
Yeah.
So do you mind, I suppose, bringing me back to when you were growing up in your family? There's five of you.
Five kids, yeah. Jesus. I'm the youngest. So mum and dad, they got married in 72 in University Church in Dublin. And then Peter came along in 74. 2 years later, Maria. 3 years later, James. 7 years later, Richard. and then 13, 14 months later, me.
Wowee.
Yeah. So there's a gap in between James and Richard. And we always joke that Richard came along and then they had to give him a friend. So then I came along after that.
And you completed the puzzle.
Completed, yes. I was number five.
So a busy household.
Busy house, yeah. Yeah, we were we're really close, the family. And dad bought the business in Mount Mallock. So he was working long hours. You know, he'd always be in and out of the shop and mum was at home with us trying to run the house.
What is the business, can I ask?
He's a pharmacist.
Oh, yeah. Okay, fine.
So mum's mum was also a pharmacist in Turles Pass in Westmeath. And yeah, then she met dad, who was set up the business in Mount Mallock. And he's still working there now.
It's
mental.
So your mum was very much present at home when you were
very
kids.
Much, yeah.
What was she like?
She was all about, we were everything to her. She was, bringing us everywhere, giving us all the opportunities. You know, we were going from music lessons to ballet to horse riding, everything. And holidays were, important to her, that we always spend time together as a family. Yeah, she was just very glam. She was all about how she looked and always buying the nicest clothes. And, she was always very well turned out.
Wow.
She would, she was really interested in people. So we used to say that she would connect all the dots. She loved listening to people's stories. She'd be able to tell you that this person was connected to that person through marriage or whatever. She'd figure it all out. And anytime there's anyone in the house, like a builder, a painter, anything like that, she'd be sitting down at them, having a cup of tea, make them fresh scones, and she'd be just sitting there listening to them. One of her best friends said to us, actually, she met you, she came to meet you where you were. She was very, she just loved listening to other people and,
And then I suppose what was, so she obviously stayed at home with ye. Did she go back into the workplace then?
So she was working with Peter, Marie and James kind of part-time. But then when it was Richard and myself, she ended up staying at home with us. So she was, just busy raising us.
Mm. And so I suppose for you then, when you grew up, it sounds like very happy memories, very happy childhood.
Very happy memories, yeah. We've the nicest memories of family. Her own brothers and sisters, she's two brothers and a sister. We were all very close. And everything was about families. At the weekends, we'd always been doing something with the family. We always knew what everyone in the family and the extended family was doing because she was in contact with everyone the whole time. She was always on the phone.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of phone calls to be making to five kids then.
Yeah. Yeah. Every single day, once we had moved out of home, every day, every one of us rang her. And we mightn't get to ring each other, but she'd be the one telling us, this is what they're doing.
She'd fill you in.
She'd fill us in, yeah. She was the WhatsApp before WhatsApp, was about.
Before it was the
thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
So when you grew up and you left, what did you do? Did you go to college or?
So I went to UCD for a year and then went to Brighton to study pharmacy in the UK.
Funnily enough, pharmacy. Yeah.
So I did pharmacy in Brighton and I met Dermot in Brighton. He was from Longford. He was 2 years ahead of me and there was a strong Irish population over there.
Okay, right.
So studied there for 4 or 5 years, moved to London, did my pre-reg training in London, moved back to Brighton for a little while, and then both myself and Dermot decided we'd travel. So we travelled for 7 or 8 months.
Yeah.
So we, and then we came back home and we were like, okay, now we have to grow up and find our permanent jobs.
Okay. So you're living at home and settled down, married, working, all the rest of it. And your mum then gets some health news.
Yeah. So we married in 2019, early 2020. We were still, myself and Dermot were still living in Dublin with my brother. And early 2020, mum was kind of just finding it hard to get over a cold, a flu, a kidney infection. Just everything was, you know, just she just found things a bit hard. She had a sore back. Just everything was kind of coming at her. Myself and Dermot went on our honeymoon then in February 2020. And we went to Kenya and Zanzibar. We flew home the day that Leo Varadkar said, we're going to close schools because of COVID. We flew home that day into the airport. Mom, and before we went, I actually remember saying to someone, I'm just uneasy about the trip. Not that I didn't want to go, but I just felt things were going to be different when I got home. I don't know what it was. I just had this sense. So we got, mum and dad collected us from the airport and actually we had a bite to eat and a coffee. And that was probably the last time for a long time that we all ate together because of COVID. Then the whole cocooning term came in and they had to both, mum had been working in the pharmacy as well. So they both had to come out of working in the pharmacy, stay at home. But she just wasn't getting better. Went to, you know, she'd numerous, you know, she was kind of like, oh no, I'm grand. It's just taking me a little bit longer. And we didn't push her really, I suppose, as much as we should have. But she went to the GP, had her bloods done, and GP rang and was like, can you get yourself to Tullamore? There was really high calcium in her bloods. So they actually thought that she was in kidney failure. So we all, each of us, the way it goes in our family, somebody gets told and then, have you rang this person? Have you rang this person? So between all the kids, we all get the news very quickly. So Dad brought mum into Tullamore, but obviously had to leave her at the door. She went in and was, you know, all the assessments and tests started to take place from there on. Now, I can't remember when it was. It might have been 1 or 2 days later, but she was told by the consultant in Tullamore that actually it was multiple myeloma, which is a blood cancer. Now, she was told that when she was just by herself in hospital. Within probably half an hour of her getting that diagnosis, Peter had come from we all came from our different workplaces and suddenly we were in our home kitchen standing around the island waiting to hear when we could go and see her. Because she was by herself with this news that we didn't know what it was. You know, COVID was difficult at the time. We couldn't just pop over to her. So we got word that we can go see her, but that was not actually see her in the ward. We went over to Tullamore in, I think, 2 separate cars. We broke the COVID rules to get into the car with each other. And we rang when we were outside. We all stood in a semicircle around Tullamore Hospital entrance in distance between us all, even though we'd all been in the car together. And they wheeled her down in a wheelchair. And we just looked like we couldn't do anything. We couldn't hug her. We just looked at her and she was just suddenly a frail lady in a wheelchair with this like life sentence.
That's so hard.
Yeah.
To not be able to just.
Yeah.
Number one, have privacy.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, to not be able to embrace each other.
Yeah.
Being so close.
Yeah. We're just, you know, you couldn't reassure each other. We couldn't help her. We're looking at her, which is the worst. It was just horrendous. And, you know, after that, we just were very proactive in getting her to the right place and the right treatment and where she needed to be and what was best for her. So we went home that we left her, like she went back in, she was wheeled back in. It was just horrendous. We were all like distraught. We went back home and it was one of those things that I always remember, all of us at home. Like Dad had said, oh, he needed to get his hair cut. And James was like, I'll do it now. So James is doing Dad's head in the kitchen. Somebody else is putting on frozen pizzas. All of a sudden, we just distract ourselves. But I remember at one point, Dad going out to the utility room and just like pressing buttons and going, I just, like, what am I even meant to do? As in, it just upset him. It just got to him there when he was out in her space and her. And I think he was just thinking, what's ahead? You know?
Yeah. It's amazing actually how when you get a diagnosis or when someone in your family gets a diagnosis, you can't help but your mind go to what if?
Yeah.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's inevitable. You're going to think that way.
Yeah.
A cancer diagnosis is just terrifying because you think, oh God, for the first time in my life, it could be a possibility that something might happen, that this person could be taken on me. And of course you go back into, no, let's not think that way. And but it's still no more than your dad. Like for a moment you're like, what if?
Yeah.
You know, it's scary.
Mum had cared for her own mum in our house for 11, 12 years she lived with us. She passed away in 2011 and her sister, mum's aunt then was a nun in the Convent of Mercy in Rosslare. And mum used to travel up and down to her then up until 2017. So she was always caring for someone.
Mm.
And then this was 2020, like she'd no reprieve. But even like when she had her sore back or whatever, I'd be very much like, you need to get up and get out and get mobile and keep yourself fit. So she was walking around the field during COVID and sending me pictures saying, I've just done 2 laps of the pitch. And I'd be like, that's great. Like, well done. But sure, she had actually, the way myeloma works is it actually pulls calcium from the bones. So they're very brittle and weak. So she actually had fractures in her spine.
That's what the pain she was feeling.
And here's me making her walk around the field.
I get it though. You didn't know anything.
I didn't know.
So she's in the hospital and does she get led home then?
She gets led home. She has been moved to Vincent's private in Dublin. And so there was a transfer of care and the consultant she was under then, they set out a treatment plan for her, which involved chemo. Now they were very much, you know, she was 71 when she was diagnosed. She's a non-smoker, non-drinker, generally fit and healthy, not overweight, anything like that. She was really, like she was on the go the whole time.
Mm.
She wouldn't step foot inside a gym, but she was very active. So they were very hopeful that myeloma was treated as a condition as opposed to cancer. So a long-term condition.
Mm-hmm.
And she was going to be hopefully a candidate for stem cell transplant,
mm-hmm.
which usually they would do kind of only in under 70. But because she was so fit and well, they felt she was able for it. So she'd a number of months of treatment of chemo going up and down to Vincent's. And then November 2020, she was going for stem cell transplant. So they take out her good cells, the good stem cells, then they completely knock her with really toxic chemo so that her immune system goes to zero. And then they replenish her with her own stem cells and they develop into wherever the cells need to go.
Okay.
And she is in isolation then for like 2 weeks, which she was used to so much isolation after COVID. COVID in a way was good because it was awful at the start, but in terms of visitors and things like that, she was quite a private person. So she didn't have to make an excuse for people calling.
Yeah. Okay.
And we were able to protect her quite well because masks. And
yeah.
So she had the stem cell transplant and that was really, really tough because you're literally knocked. They basically say, like, you're just knocked to complete flat. Your immune system is just zilch. And then each day they're monitoring, you know, how she's doing. And there's one nurse allowed in with her who, like, we just owed everything to because she was doing all the communication with us and she was just amazing. So at that point, she looked sick because her hair had, she'd lost her hair. Now she had decided, we had decided to, before it fell out naturally, myself and my sister went with her to decide on a wig and things like that. So she was looking sick then at that point. But the stem cell treatment worked in that her body fought back and all the bad cells were gone, all the good cells, you know, she was in a good place. Now, I wouldn't say she was thriving, but she was managing to, once her, after they kind of, the 100-day mark is a big mark in terms of how her bloods are. So 100, they start from day zero is the day that she gets her own new cells back in. So day 100, she was doing well and they were happy. So yeah, she kind of tried to carry on and have a bit more of her usual life, which was travel and go places. And
she's in good form herself about it all.
She was in quite good form. Her hair had started to grow back. She'd kind of joke about it, but like, more than anything, it was her hair that bothered her, you know?
Yeah.
Because it took away her sense of identity, I suppose, like totally. She found that really the hardest. And nobody had, she didn't even see herself without, it was only me that actually had seen her without in the hairdressers where it was done, because she couldn't look at herself.
Yeah.
She just found it too hard.
It's an important point. Yeah. A lot of people have to go through that, don't they? And yeah, especially someone like your mum, who obviously loved her appearance and glam and turning herself out, and it's important to her.
So important to her.
To lose that, it strips a person of who they are, really, doesn't it?
We got it, like, we went to this in the hairdresser place that was specialising in that. They took us into a private room and just the noise of the razor was just unbelievable. And then they stepped out and mum turned around to me. There was no mirrors or anything. And she turned around to me and she was like, well, I'm like, what do you say?
I know, it's hard, isn't it?
Yeah, that was awful. But no, she was good in 2021. When I say good, like, she just was able to put a little bit of, she was on oral treatment to keep the cancer at bay. So she didn't have to be in the hospital as much. She was able to organize, you know, a few more trips. And
yeah. So I suppose big shift in all of your lives, really.
Yeah, totally. Like, our sense of everything then became about, God, we never thought mum might be someone we'd lose. I don't know why, just mum was, yeah.
So I suppose in 2021, she's doing quite well and it's not that you're thinking she's going anywhere.
Not at all, by any shape or form. We just thought, like, after the stem cell transplant, she'd be in remission for a few years, then it might come back and then she'll have to go through the same again with chemo in hospital. But her consultant was very happy that we were treating it as a condition as opposed to a cancer.
Okay. So I suppose at that point then, do you have thoughts about your own kind of family and starting a family?
Yeah. So yeah, we had tried and we got pregnant, I think it was around Easter 2020. It was after honeymoon and everything. And I remember just being absolutely shocked because I have just PCOS, but only in a mild, you know, so I never knew my cycle. So I kind of thought, oh, my cycle's all over the place. But anyway, I found out I was pregnant. Couldn't tell at what stage I was at, again, because I didn't know my cycle. So I went to the GP who did a blood test, really high HCG. She said, you're probably in around 6-7 weeks. So I went to get a private scan just to see what the story was. And in there, they said, okay, I could see the ultrasound. And like at the time didn't know what any of it meant, but now I'm an expert in ultrasound scans. So there was just silence. And then she said, okay, we'll do an internal scan. And So I could see the sack, but basically she just said, we're not sure, what we'll need to do is get you back in 10 days. And I was like, what? Like, what do you mean I'm not sure? I need to get you back in 10 days. 10 days is like torture.
Yeah.
And I spoke to my GP and she was like, just go up to the early pregnancy unit, because I'd already been in touch with Hollis Street about registering with them. Went up to them and of course it was COVID, Dermot had to stay out. And they said, usually, they said the same thing. There is a sac, but the embryo has stopped growing. It's called a blighted ovum. And they said, we would have to wait 10 days, a week to 10 days to confirm it. I was like, I've already been on another scan. Like, what? You know, I'm very much like black or white. If it's not, you know, just...
I want to know now.
I want to know now.
Yeah.
So there was a gestational sac and that continued to grow and develop. So I continued to have pregnancy symptoms. But they said, so I needed a DNC, which they now call ERPC, evacuation of retained products of conception, surgery. Now, they did say we could give you medication and you can go through this at home, but there's no guarantee of that everything would be cleared. And I had had surgeries before and I was like, it's okay. The surgery seems like the better option. So they couldn't schedule me in for another week or 10 days. So I just went back to work and I was like,
it's awful,
oh my God,
isn't it?
Here I am, like having all the pregnancy symptoms. I have, you know, something growing inside me. But anyway, I was scheduled for the DNC and went and had that done under general anaesthetic. And then I was kind of like, okay, that's it. You know, I was really unfortunate, really unlucky. We'll go again. We'll, you know, see what happens from then. So that was done. And then finally my cycle went back to what it should have been, which was normal for me, which wasn't normal, but carried on. So after that, it was taking us, once everything, as far as I was concerned, was back to normal, it took us then a good bit of time. We weren't able to get pregnant, or it seemed that we weren't able to. So at that point, I sought help from the fertility clinic. I just registered with them and I was like, sure, what harm?
Yeah.
I'll get some tests done just to see. So they said, because I started what's called ovulation induction with them, because I had PCOS, I wasn't regularly ovulating, which would mean, you know, maybe there's only 3 chances in the year that I might ovulate myself and get, so it would be very difficult for me to get pregnant. So ovulation induction is where they encourage ovulation.
Make you more regular.
Yeah. Mm. I started that with them. So it's not full IVF, it's just some injections. And I got pregnant. And so went through the whole, okay, this is it this time. But then that, before I'd even, I think I'd had one scan, but then that, the line faded. It was a chemical miscarriage.
Okay.
A chemical pregnancy, which is now counted as a miscarriage, lately it used to be counted.
At that point then, can I tap into you as a person?
Yeah.
How was that affecting you?
Like, I was like, how could this happen again? Like, I know it was something happened to me once, but that was just a once off. Like, this, you know, why is this happening again? I started to, you know, retreat a little bit into myself. I kind of was less going to, I was kind of a little bit of social anxiety and I just didn't want to. And this is only the start of all that, but I just definitely started to notice that I was kind of not quite myself. And I'd even at just events, big events, and they could be all my best friends, but I'd find them really hard.
Yeah.
And not that there was like babies running around or people with, it was just, I just found it hard to just carry on that everything was okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because between that and mum.
Yeah. So going back to mum, how was she feeling at this time?
So mum was, herself and dad did another like 1 or 2 trips. They were doing really well. Then she felt like a lump in her side. And we were like, well, no, she's not long after her transplant. Like, it hardly could have come back so soon. And mum and dad were 50 years married in 22. So we had a celebration for them in Dublin. It was lovely. All their closest friends and mum even spoke, which she never would usually. She took the mic and was like, now I'd like to connect all my friends. So she'd her school friends and her later life friends. And she was just, she was in great form. But the next day she was going in to Vincent's just for them to have a look at this lump to see what it was. And we kind of actually, you know, we were a little bit worried, but we were like, no, it's probably, it's not that. Because previously it didn't, her cancer hadn't manifested as lumps or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But what it was a cluster of myeloma cells. So they said, okay, so she was out of remission. We're going to need to start treatment again. So mum had Portugal holiday booked with myself, Dermot and dad. So it was a matter of, she said to them, is it okay to go? They said, go on the holiday. So we went on the holiday. It was lovely. Mum was in a lot of pain. She wasn't well, but she pretended to be well. And myself, I remember myself and dad in contact with the hospital, and they were like, I think you're going to have to tell her, you know, at this point she needs to come home, because I think she was really having a lot of pain. We were helping her to walk, but she kept saying, no, it's none of my bones. Just please leave me be. I am really enjoying it. And she almost then turned on this, like, I'm absolutely fine. And wouldn't even admit then to her own complaints. And we knew she was in agony. So I remember one evening, like, Peter, Maria, James and Richard, we were all in contact, and they said, like, we're going to need to get her to come home. You're going to have to see, you're going to have to talk to her. So we were sitting outside, and mum was like, I stopped talking, and mum was like, what's wrong? And I was like, mum, the hospital want you to go home. You're going to have to go home. And I kind of didn't expect the reaction that I got. I thought she would just maybe get upset and be like, okay. But she was like, no, not going home. And I was like, didn't think of that as an answer. I was like, oh, what are the other four going to say at home to me that I didn't try hard enough? She was like, no, I am staying here. I'm here now. The sun is good for my bones. I'm fine. I'm absolutely fine. There was no talking to her. So she stayed. Myself and Dermot came home after a few days, and my older brother went out. So he to her for, like, they were there for a period of 10 days, 2 weeks maybe in total. So we were there for the first little part, and then my brother went out. And they had a lovely holiday, spent lots of nice time together. But we all knew mum was in agony and pain and just pretending. She wouldn't give in to it because she was like, I don't want anyone to say to me, you shouldn't have gone, you know. So they came home from that holiday, and she was due to go into Vincent's. She was due to go into hospital to start the treatment. So they were going to start radiation. My best friend was getting married in Ibiza. So myself and Richard, my closest brother, the two of us traveled to Ibiza. It felt bizarre, but mum was like, why wouldn't you go? As in, there's no need to be concerned. Like, you have to go. And I was a bridesmaid as well. And we were out there, and I was like, yeah, sure, mum's fine. And I decided for 2 days of the wedding that I wasn't going to go near my phone, because I was like, if I'm really needed, there's hundreds of ways they can get in contact with me. Richard's here. You know, I just personally, I'm not going to carry my phone. And it was the nicest thing to do, because I just was able to kind of check out a little bit.
Mm.
And came home. I had escaped COVID the whole time, but I came home and I got COVID from Ibiza or the plane or something. Yeah. And dad rang and said, we need to get mum to hospital. And he, at this point, she couldn't walk. She couldn't. Something happened, and they rang the hospital. The hospital said, you need to get her up here. And I couldn't help because I had COVID. So I remember my brother-in-law got her into the car. I had to stand watching her try to come down the stairs and her get into the car. They went up to Vincent's, and that from that period was just, she was different then. They started radiation treatment to try and shrink the cluster. That was really hard on her. She found it really, really difficult and was in so much pain. And she'd always be on her phone messaging us and keeping in contact with the world. Like, they'd never know she was messaging from her hospital bed, but she'd be like online shopping and doing all sorts, and people would be getting gifts at their door. And So that was around kind of November. Yeah, she was really not well. But they let her home on November 14th for Dad's birthday. And we felt, oh, this is great. Maybe this is the start of Mum coming back again. But she wasn't the same at all. She couldn't. She was very frail. We were terrified of infection. But at the same time, it was Dad's birthday and the whole family had to be there. So all of us gathered that night in the house. And so literally all of us, grandchildren, all of us there, forgetting about the infection risk for those that hour or two, and had a cake for Dad's birthday. So she was at home for that period of time. And on the day of the toy show, Maria, my sister, and Mum's best friend, Mary Culleton, brought her to the hairdresser because she always wanted to look, well turned out, and came back and went to bed for the afternoon. She did do an afternoon nap or whatever. So that evening then, Maria lived across the way. So she came over for when she would supposedly be getting up for her evening kind of meal, and she'd usually be up for the evening then, but she didn't. Dad was like, no, she's just sleeping on, like she's not getting up. So Maria was up with her and she felt she was they just felt she wasn't right. So Maria texted me or rang me and said her temperature's a bit up and she's kind of shaking. And I was like, okay, this doesn't sound good. So I'm down the way, myself and Dermot are like, let's go up. When we got to the house, Mum was confused, she just didn't know. She was a totally different person. Her temperature was high. She couldn't really get out of the bed and she was starting to get, just say funny things, which was so unusual because earlier in the day she was at the hairdresser's and she was fine. Mm. And her hair was lovely.
It was a quick turnabout.
A really, really quick. And then it was literally, you could see it happening in front of your eyes. She was just deteriorating right in front of us. And it was a matter of, okay, we need to get her to the hospital. Mm. And James and Dermot, my husband, lifted Mum down the stairs. I'll never get that image out of my head. Because she was such a small woman and they just had to, it just was horrible to see her so weak in their arms. We drove her up, and in the car on the way up, even like before we got to the motorway, all the turns and all like that, I was like, don't worry, Mum, sorry. We're almost on the straight road, because she was just in pain. Her body was in pain, like her bones were aching, but she wasn't making any sense. And I was like, we're on the motorway. So we arrive into Vincent's, and honestly, it was such a relief to see Richard. He was literally waiting at the door of Vincent's private because there was a porter there as well. But we were like, can Richard do it? Because he knows how to lift her because she needed to be lifted a certain way. Like, Richard lifted her up to the room and he just couldn't believe. He kind of thought maybe we were overreacting. Mm. Brought her up to the room, but she got into the room and she greeted the nurse like with her name. We're like, oh. Mum's fine, you know. Yeah. She just had a split moment of, hi, how are you? I'm back again. So we were waiting in the family room close by and they said, look, she's responding to the antibiotics. We need to assess her. Just go home and get a sleep. And, you know, if one of you want to stay, that's fine. And I was like, why are they saying that? Like, why would they need one of us to stay? But I was kind of in denial. Maria stayed in the room with her overnight, and she was keeping in contact with us, which was great because she was saying, partly she said to Maria, oh, does Rosamund have enough petrol now to get home? She was always worried about me and my petrol. She was like, does Rosamund have enough petrol to get home? And the night was okay as far as we could see. We were able to sleep, you know, and be like, okay, we'll wake up in the morning and she'll have turned a corner. Dad went to work. We were like, he just wasn't thinking. He was there for 9 o'clock, and by 10 o'clock we had got him out of there. We were like, you know, my brother had arranged for another pharmacist to go in and cover because he just was not thinking. He can't believe now he went into work. So those couple of days we went up to Vincent's the Saturday, Sunday, all of us as family, and it was actually, you know, it was a nice time as well. We were all together and in and out to mum. Then she was moved to HGU. We said, right, okay, well, I suppose this is good because at least she's getting more attention. We kept thinking of the good things out of everything. We were like, okay, that's good. There's more attention on her now. She's moved to HGU and they said, if each of you want to come up two by two to just talk to her, say something to her. So that was really hard because I had seen her the night before in the car and next thing I saw her in HGU. And, you know, she was able to say, she just said, how is this happening or why is this happening to me? I went in with Richard and we were just trying to, you just don't know what to say. And you're like, I just remember saying, Mum, please, please, you're not going anywhere. Promise me. But at the same time, I was saying it, but I was not believing it. I was like, she actually isn't going anywhere. I'm probably being dramatic here. Like she's, you know, she'll be fine. And then it was HGU. Well, now we need to move her to ICU. And we're like, okay, why do we need to go to ICU? And we went in. You know, we were taking turns going in and one by one and people between us all, we were like, no, you go this time. We were all been too nice to each other. No, I'll let you go in. So on the Saturday evening, we went in and the doctor was happy with her and said, no, she is responding quite well. So we all went home. That was fine. Came back up Sunday. She was in ICU, but they said we might just move her to a separate room just because of infection. And we're like, okay, is that really why? So yeah, and then she started to, at this point she really wasn't responsive. She was totally distressed and delirious and, you know, we were all sitting beside her at different times. We'd take turns and she just, you know, we knew she wasn't going to get better at that point. And on the Tuesday morning then the doctors had... They had a planned meeting with us. So we knew kind of what was coming. But in a way, we all still regret this because we were all in the room with Mum. So it was Peter, Maria, James, Richard, myself and Dad, all in the room with Mum together before the meeting. So we all left the room all at once. Like, we all now are saying, why did we do that? James is like, no, I'll stay behind with her. Thank God. He was like, I'm going to stay behind with her. Because as much as she wasn't aware of going on, of course she knew her family were there and then her family were gone. And so James stayed with her and the rest of us went in for the meeting. And the meeting was as we thought it would be. And, you know, do you want us to continue to try? She's very sick. She has sepsis from E. coli. And it wasn't actually that her cancer got bad at that point. It was that she was so, her immune system was so suppressed that she developed sepsis. And, you know, we had a couple of questions about like, if she fights the sepsis, where does she stand in terms of her cancer? And they said, if she gets through the sepsis, it itself is months of recovery just for her organs to get over. So we had to come to a decision there and so straight away then they took away machines and made the room like a nice room for us. And we called whoever we had to call, all the husbands and wives.
So obviously you've all come to a point where you've had this meeting with the doctors and you know the outcome is not good. And as you say, they turn the room into what's supposed to be nice, but you know you're kind of on the final journey now. And you all gather together. How's your mum at this point? Is she peaceful?
Yeah, she even looks, you know, more relaxed in herself. Mm. It was easier to kind of sit by her side. And that night, which we kind of figured would be the last night, all of us were in the family room close by. And we actually had a really night, you know, when you're exhausted and you're delirious and we'd go into fits of laughter about this or that. And they actually let Dad in beside Mum, in a bed beside Mum. It was heartbreaking. To lie beside her for a few hours that night. And then the next morning they told us when it was that, you know, it was going to happen and we were all there with her, every one of us. I was holding her hand on one side, Dad was on the other side and she, a tear came down her face. So she definitely, we knew she was in the room with us at that point. And I don't know if everyone quite saw the tear, but it came down, I saw it. And it was just, you know, but I was relieved for her then, because the previous few days were horrible, really horrible. Yeah, it wasn't nice. It's just like, even after, you know, the normal things that have to go on, like I needed to go to the bathroom. I was like, this is so strange. Like, mom is just right beside me, but she's just passed away. I was okay. I was actually just, I think I was okay at that point. Okay, in the sense of like there was just so many people around, and we had so much to organize that, you know, I didn't allow myself to think that much.
Mm.
I couldn't believe what had happened, yeah. But I was so focused on, okay, how, like, what now? And mum's not here, so we need to, you know, get things, like, organize things and figure out life without mum. And, you know, we were, like, I had to hoover the place, you know. And it's just, you're doing wild. Such a weird thing around your, like, it was, you know, we made lighthearted moments out of those moments. We had to. But yeah.
When your mom is gone, so her funeral is lovely. You were telling me that they played "You'll Never Walk Alone."
Yeah. It's funny because we're a fully Man United house. No, full Man United house. She was part of the Portleash choir, and they always sang that song and sang it very well. So that was her song. And like, even leaving the church, Dad just stopped in the middle of the aisle just to like reflect. It was so poignant. None of us expected it. We didn't know what was happening, but everyone just, you know, stood still for a moment, and it was really nice.
I find that song very emotional, isn't it?
Totally. Yeah.
Often hear it at a funeral.
Yeah. It's really like, and we all thought it kind of wouldn't be, that all the boys would be like, no, you can't have that. But no, it meant a lot. Yeah. It was very significant. And like, there was just huge, it was hundreds at the funeral.
Yeah.
Because Dad was the local pharmacist. And,
yeah.
And, and mum so knew loved. Everyone.
Yeah.
Everyone.
Very loved woman, obviously. Yeah.
If this conversation has resonated with you, or if you're navigating grief of your own, I've recently opened a gentle support space called After the Flowers. It's a low-cost monthly membership for people who are grieving, whether that's the loss of a person, a relationship, or a sense of home. It includes group conversations, live Zoom support calls, and sessions focused on supporting the nervous system through grief, like breath work, meditation, and grounding practices. There's no pressure at all. It's simply there if and when it feels right for you. The link is in the bio.
After all of that.
Yeah.
How did you cope?
Obviously,
it knocked you sideways.
Knocked me sideways. I felt like, you know, what's going to go right? Everything's going wrong.
Yeah.
You know, I went back to, I was kind of, the week mum was in the hospital and the week after, and then I went back to work because that's what I do. And that's what we all did, because that's how we
cope.
And, you know, people say, was it too soon? I actually don't think it was. It was right for me at the time.
Yeah.
But you suddenly realise that people's little problems are just little problems, and you're like, do you know what's just happened?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that was all, the weeks after, I found really hard, because every evening after work, I'd ring mum in the car on the way home. Every evening. So then I converted to ringing Richard every evening. Because he couldn't always get Dad. He'd be in work himself. So I'd ring Richard every evening, just because I had to fill that space.
Yeah.
It was just really, really, like, because Christmas was upon us, and we don't really remember Christmas. It was just, she had all her presents wrapped and done. People were like, oh, she must have known. But that's who she was. She always had her Christmas shopping done since September. We were like, no, she didn't.
Mm.
She really didn't.
She was just highly organized.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And she loved giving. Like, she was just always giving.
She liked that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But a huge loss.
Huge, huge loss. And we found it hardest for Dad, because I was like, I'm going through a different grief to Dad. Dad's lost his soulmate. His, you know, they'd have their deepest chats lying in bed at night. You know, that I found it so hard for Dad to be going through what he was going through. I was not thinking about my own grief. I was just thinking about Dad's.
Mm, yeah. That can happen.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking to watch someone else.
Yeah.
Suffer in front of you. Ooh. Again, in a different way. I mean, you watched your mom suffer. Now you're watching your dad in a different way.
Yeah.
Suffer. It's hard. Yeah,
very hard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I suppose you guys running alongside all of this, your story is kind of so
yeah.
But I suppose back to, you know, you now, life has changed so much and grief is ever present. It's a big, big part of your life and it's complicated and things change and the family environment changes and you worry about your dad and there's so many things happening. But I suppose also you're still on that fertility road.
Yeah.
What's happening there at that point when your mum passes away?
Just prior to mum passing away, we are in a period of that time. We had another chemical pregnancy, which is where it was positive, where we thought, and then it was another chemical. And we got pregnant from an ovulation induction cycle. And this is with the fertility clinic. We were in and out, had scans. It was great. I was like, this is it. Now it's finally our time. And then it came to 13 weeks, no heartbeat. We couldn't fathom it at all. So we went through the same process. Bawled crying in the car outside the clinic, went to Hollis Street, had another DNC. I was in the same room I was in from the first one. This at the time was massive, but now when I talk about it, I'm like, this, you know, this was this date and then that happened. But at the time, you know, my whole life was taken over by it. I had to have another DNC because, again, I had retained tissue. And at this point, because I'd had four miscarriages, they were investigating. So I had, they discovered that we had genetic testing, we had fallopian tubes flush, I had every kind of test done. And they discovered that that miscarriage was trisomy 16, which is incompatible with life, but it was a spontaneous genetic mutation. So there was nothing that, it was just another one of those things.
Was it breaking your spirit?
Totally. Like I was breaking. Like I'd be at anything and tears would just come on me. I'd have to leave. But it got to the point where people knew, just leave her, you know, just leave her to whatever she decides to do. I'd say things like, I'll go, but I might not stay that long. And people understood. They just understood that I wasn't comfortable being somewhere and trying to be in good form for a certain length of time. Like, it was exhausting to be in good form. And it was like, work was probably the only place that I could completely just block it out for that number of hours, because I was focusing on helping other people. And then it was home, and then it would be tears all evening and waiting for this and waiting for the next test and waiting for the next appointment. And then at this appointment, they said this. So then I have to wait for, everything was waiting. I was just slowly, I honestly was slowly breaking.
It's torture, isn't it? Because you don't know the outcome.
No.
And so,
yeah, that's it. If somebody could,
you're not really able to, if someone's like, it's not going to happen, then you could like sit and grieve.
Yeah.
But also you can't do that because you're still focused on making it happen.
Yeah.
And so it does become all about dates and times and weight and tests and this and that. But I think it, like listening to you, it's like, I think a real important part is that people get to process any type of loss they have. And those are all losses along the way. But, you know, miscarriage, baby loss, all of that is, it's really unspoken about. So you're very much on your own. You're very much at home and no one's mentioning it.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't want them to mention it anyway. But I think it's an important process.
Yeah.
But it's you're kind of stuck within this system nearly.
Yeah.
It's difficult, isn't it?
It's really difficult. And people don't know. They really don't know. Like, they tried to say the right things. At least you got pregnant, you know.
Yeah.
All this type of at least. People really do not know unless they've been in it.
Yeah.
The trenches, the fertility trenches, as they say. So, you know, it was just, it was so, so tough. And I was slowly like going, I'm becoming a different person. I relied on things like, I'd look at all the programs got to do with miscarriages and infertility and listen to all the podcasts. And that did help me. Like, I would just walk and walk and walk and listen. Because I was like, this happens to other people. It is not just me.
Yeah.
You know, there'd be some people that would say, oh yeah, no, I had a miscarriage. But no matter what, you're like, oh, but have you had four? Like, the and the way that, the, you know, you just think that you must be the only one. Because I'd had, I felt like I had had all different sorts. I'd had a blighted ovum. I'd had a chemical pregnancy. I'd had a loss due to a genetic mutation. I was like, what other type of ones can I have? But yet there was nothing wrong.
Does it feel like you've kind of said it, but is it very isolating? Because like you hear that stat, like every woman can say, not every woman, what was it, one in four can say they've had a miscarriage?
Yeah.
So like in a group of seven or eight friends, maybe two or three people have had a miscarriage. It's so common.
Yeah.
However, what you're describing isn't common.
Yeah.
You know, that's narrowing it down again a bit more. So it makes you feel very different.
Yeah.
And then when people say, oh yeah, I know, it's so, you know, that term drives me wild. At least you can get pregnant. Sure, keep going. And you're very much pushed to one side. Like, people aren't understanding how horrendous this is and how different it is. It's not just a couple of miscarriages, but it's like, as you said, it's happening and it's happening again and then it's happening again and it's all different reasons.
Yeah.
Like, it, I can't even imagine what that does to a person mentally. It must be really hard.
Yeah. Like, my whole life, like, honestly, not one or two minutes would go by without me thinking, should I be doing this now? Should I be doing that now? Like, getting rid of all the plastic, using glass. Like, I was fully committed to, I was like, there's nothing, I'm not, I was doing all the things I should be doing. And you feel like, yeah, there's the one in four who have a miscarriage. But then you're like, yeah, but how many are having this amount? And what's next? And
what is next? Do you, at a point, think this is my fault?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. And I like, oh, is it because when I was younger, I had ovarian cysts and I had two surgeries and it was confirmed, it was nothing got to do with it, but I was like, it had to have been. And actually, about a week before mum passed away, I was lying in the bed beside her and she said, I always felt that you'd have trouble, fertility trouble. And I was like, really, why? And she was like, I don't know, I can't put my finger on it. So I don't know what, you know, I don't know what. So January after mum passed away, she passed away November 30th. January after she passed away, I started, had an IVF cycle and got pregnant. Couldn't believe it. Every scan was going well. I was with a consultant in Dublin.
Thrilled. Because this one was staying.
We were up and down every time we went. He was seeing me regularly because of my history. Mm. We'd go for a scan, we'd go for a bite to eat. It was great.
So you obviously get past the 12-week mark. You probably still be nervous because you were at that point before.
Yeah. I remember we went away with Dermot's family for a weekend and I saw that there was a clinic that were doing like scans. And I was like, I'm going to go in and get one just because I was like paranoid. So it was like a 14 or 15 week and yeah, everything was fine.
Amazing.
I still had regular, I was constantly in contact with my consultant anyway. But one day, Friday in work, I felt pain, what I can only describe as kind of pains or pulling feeling. The other pharmacist was there. So I left about 3 or 4 o'clock. He was like, just go on home. So I planned on sitting up for the evening in just sitting up on the couch, not moving. And went to the loo and basically I had what I now know is bulging membranes that burst. I rang Hollis Street. They said, like, you're going to have to get yourself to somewhere close by because the Bruce Springsteen concert is on. You won't get to Hollis Street for hours because obviously I'd be coming from Laois. So I went to Port Laois. My husband came from work. My sister was just at the door. He had contacted her. She brought me over, went into A&E there, and they saw me straight away and said, okay, your waters have broken, but, you know, the heartbeat is still strong. If your cervix hasn't dilated, you know, there's hope that we can, yeah, that we can stitch it in and keep this pregnancy.
And you're how many weeks at this point?
18. So they examine the cervix and they say, no, it's dilated, and also you have a cord prolapse. So the cord was also, had moved down. So basically it's what's called a preterm rupture of membranes with cord prolapse. So they said, you know, there is nothing we can do. And just, we had to basically go back to the maternity ward, and just, I was admitted there until either I went into labour or I showed some signs of infection. So went back to the maternity ward, and they couldn't induce me because they're not a fetal specialist unit. And Matthew's heartbeat was so strong, like, they couldn't, there was nothing they could do. Ethically, it would be, you know, wrong to intervene at that point.
So similar to the Savita Halepiner case.
Yeah.
What was going on in your head? What did you want? What did you feel?
I just was like, I knew this, this of course is, you know, I'm such a fool for thinking I was going to hold this pregnancy. Like, of course I'm here and of course I'm in this situation, and except this time I actually have to give birth. You know, other times I had four surgeries, but now I actually have to go through the process. And I just was kind of checked out.
Devastated as well.
And they gave us a really nice room on the maternity ward. And our families kind of came, just checked in on us. And Dermot at that point, he broke down. And he wouldn't have prior to that. He was always strong. He broke down because he was like, this is happening to us again. So they checked me every 4 hours. And as I said, they couldn't do anything. Because his heartbeat was so strong. But later on the Saturday evening, I showed signs of infection. So they said, okay, now we can induce you because there's a sign that you're at risk. I had asked for antibiotics prior to this, but because I was in between the 12 and the 24 week mark, it's a grey area. So if I was 24 weeks, I could have been given antibiotics.
Essentially,
but because I was 18.
Essentially, they start waiting for you to deteriorate. I'm saying because they can't intervene.
Yeah.
They wait until you become ill.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. This was, yeah.
And so then they can do something.
Yeah. So they said at that point, okay, now we have to induce you. So they started the induction that night, on the Saturday night, and agony, total agony, but they could give me different painkillers that they wouldn't have been able to give somebody who was about to have a baby that was alive.
Yeah. And was Matthew's heartbeat still present?
Yeah. And it only started to slow really close to the end. So they were inducing me because of the risk of infection, and then his heartbeat, yeah, continued quite strong throughout, and then it was only towards the end. So I go into labour and give birth to Matthew on Sunday morning. My consultant in Hollis Street had been in touch with the on-call consultant in Port Laois. They actually knew each other, thankfully, and he said, basically, a watch out for her. She has sticky placenta because of my previous retained tissue. So they had theatre ready, thankfully, for me. So I gave birth, and everything after that was a flash because I started to vomit. My teeth were chattering. I was shaking. My chest was all building up with fluid. there was an alarm going off, but I was like, I'm in the delivery suite. It's probably an alarm from a pregnant lady. I had no idea. I just remember going into a lift and going into theatre and people coming from everywhere and all different teams coming at me, all different areas. And then I just remember saying, can you put me out? Please, can you put me out? So they had theatre prepared for me because they were going to manually remove the placenta because they knew I'd have trouble with it. So so that was where my story, I'm just, you know, there. To Dermot at this point, they had to speak to him and say she deteriorated. Her organs are failing. She has flash pulmonary edema, which was the feeling of the drowning feeling that I had in my lungs. And my organs were failing and she is now intubated and can you call family? So family, dad was in mass, walked out in the middle of the mass. So the whole of Killinard knew there was something wrong. So they were all over in the hospital for the day. And they were told I had sepsis. So this is dad, it was November. He was with mum by her side with sepsis and this is May. And I was intubated and they said she could be intubated for a few days. We don't know how this is going to go. It's critical. Next 24 hours, critical. Next 48 hours, critical. She's not out of the woods. So that was that point. I had, severe sepsis with septic shock, multi-organ failure, and, fluid in my lungs. So Dermot stayed that night in ICU and they said to him, would you like to see Matthew? At that point, we hadn't given him a name, but he said they advised him seeing him because they didn't know if I'd get to see him. So he saw him then. And then I miraculously came around and I didn't know what had gone on. Like I was still, when I woke up, I was intubated still. And I just wrote on something like with my fingertip, Dad, Dermot. So they got them and...
How long after you given birth was this when you woke up?
This was like 36 hours later, I think. 24 to 36 hours, which they didn't expect me to wake up that soon. But thankfully, maybe because I was fighting fit otherwise, you know, it really stood in my favour. And like I was somebody who was, you know, always out and about and exercising and relatively healthy, and maybe it didn't at all, but that's just what I told myself. So I was in ICU then for, you know, they couldn't take me out of ICU because I had a central, my organs had to recover and they didn't know if they would come back, but every single one of my organs came back fine.
Wow.
And
you woke up from this nightmare.
Yeah.
When do you get to see your baby?
So I was in ICU for a week. Then I was moved back to the maternity ward where Dermot had stayed in that room that we had been put in. He was there the whole time because he used to have to come down to ICU and stay with me. So I saw Matthew when I went back to the maternity ward. Before I had seen him, you know, we had to make a decision about cremation or... but after I saw him then I was like, I can't cremate. So we chose to bury him with mum. So we had to bring or whoever organized it, organized the same undertaker, and they're unbelievable. They're unbelievable people that I didn't know anything got to do with how they do this. I was like, what do I do? What do I pay them? How do I organize it? And they were just like, you don't have to think about anything. It's like, you know, an unwritten rule that they won't ever, it's not like they're going to turn around and charge you for. So I was in the maternity ward for a while.
What's that like? Because obviously there's babies everywhere.
The first night back was great because I was out of ICU and I didn't have a bed that was blowing up and blowing down and blowing up and blowing down and wires and whatever. I was glad to be out of ICU, but it was a nice room, a double bed with a TV, but it was on the corridor with crying babies. But you know, I actually was able to block it out because I was like, this is where I am and I'm at the other side of it. I'm going to be better now. But also, I'm never going to have children now.
That's what's coming into your head then.
Yeah. Because I had to, I'm always like, okay, now I need to plan the next thing. Like, I can't dwell, not that I can't dwell, but I just have to be, I have to preoccupy my mind. A huge part of helping me with my grief was the day I was discharged, I went to see a puppy, which I'd wanted for ages. A mum had said, why don't you just get him? Because I'd always grown up with dogs. I was like, oh no, I can't, like, at work. Anyway, I got Sally, and yeah, she was great for helping me all those weeks at home when I was getting home IVs. Nurses would come in every day at lunch, and my sister would come down and sit with me when they came in to administer IVs. And yeah, I was lucky to be alive.
That's absolutely understatement. Yes, you almost died.
Yeah. And I didn't get the gravitas of it at all. You know,
you didn't.
I didn't, because I was like, well, I didn't experience all those meetings they had, the tears throughout the night, the, oh my God, is she going to make it? The family, like, reading all these reports about, like, what had happened to Sunita Halilapanavar, you know, so they were going through all that. I didn't go through that, you know.
And it was very similar what happened to Sunita.
Very similar. Very, very similar.
And how was your husband when you came home? Shook, I imagine.
Shook, and just so grateful that things had ended up. He was like, I was going to lose both of you. And once we were over my recovery, then we were like, look at what happened to us. We've actually buried Matthew now. You know, like, we were like, this is us again. Like, I got over my health part and I was like, okay, let's talk about the fact that, again, we've lost another.
Yeah.
So that's
when... Did you do that? Did you sit with that for a little while?
No, probably not. I didn't sit with anything.
No, that's okay. But that's the whole point.
Yeah.
You know, some people can come in here and weep over, and other people can't. And it's like, there's no right way.
Yeah.
Like, there is no right way.
Mm.
I can see in you that you are getting to the point in life, you go from A to B in a different direction to someone else.
Yeah.
You still arrive. You're still here in front of, you're still sitting here in front of me like many other people.
Yeah.
But it's, the experience is so different for so many people. But I feel with you that it's quite hard to go there and sit there, or you don't see the point in it, or maybe it's how you need to function, is that you need to be able to not go there.
Yeah.
Do you ever have?
Yeah, I do have moments where I just completely break down, but they will literally be periods of 20 minutes to half an hour. It might be by the grave, or it might just be when I'm out for a walk, and I will absolutely be distraught. I definitely do. Mm. And there is no, like, you know, my makeup could be all over the place and I'm an absolute mess. And you'd see me 15 minutes later and I'm just talking away like normal.
Yeah.
So I definitely do have those moments. But I very much probably try to
keep moving. Yeah.
Mm.
So then after Matthew.
So after Matthew, we obviously, there was a big concern between us that if I were to get pregnant again, the health issue I had been through and what had gone on, and would I be able to get pregnant again, and even the amount that we had spent on fertility up to that point.
You're talking vast amounts of money.
Yeah. Thousands. And then I was like, do I keep trying, putting my body at risk and keep spending these thousands and thousands?
Yeah.
Or do we look at other options? And I had never thought, I wouldn't have ever thought about something like surrogacy, because in my head I'm like, oh, that's, celebrities do that. That's not open to us.
Kim K.
Yeah. And in Ireland, it's very difficult because you have to, one of the criteria is to be under 40 and finish your family. Now, I'm the youngest in my family. You know, my sister-in-law, they were all out of that criteria as much as they would have absolutely helped me. Very few people are finished their family at 40 now. Ireland wasn't an option. I spent that summer that I was at home, or not summer, the kind of May, June, July, yeah, researching Ireland, England, how could I do this? And somebody got in touch with me that didn't know I was researching surrogacy, but she knew of my story and just reached out through a friend to say, if she ever wants to talk to me, you know, just do that. And I was like, God, if other people are thinking that, I'm not just crazy myself. And my consultant was in agreement. The fertility clinic were like, we can't go near you at this point. You're physically and mentally crushed. You know, I sat there in front of them and just broke down. And they were like, you know, for now,
we
won't even accept you, even if you forced yourself to do something with us. So I had done my research in different countries and whatever. And when I got in touch with this person who helped me all along, so she was amazing. But she, the agency and people she lined up with were all ones that I had come to. I had meetings with different people. They were, and they matched, you know, the agency that I felt was very nothing untoward, all above board. So basically, we decided, yeah, to do surrogacy. So for somebody else to carry our embryos. We had embryos in Cork in the clinic. So it was a matter of organizing embryos to travel to where we had decided, which was Ukraine. For a lot of different reasons, there's different reasons for different countries, but Ukraine for us was the right one at the time. Mm. And myself and Dermot would be on the birth cert. In other countries, that's not the case.
Yes.
So our embryos left Cork with this very nice man. There's actually a job for somebody who is an IVF courier. We saw them off in Cork and they went from Cork in a nitrogen tank on by plane to London, Vienna, Bratislava, and to Ukraine in a nitrogen tank. He took a picture all the way of it. It can't go through x-ray or anything like that. So there's a very important way of transporting them. So we sent two embryos and that was the start of what we were like, well, we'll hope for the best, but we don't know. And we were matched with a surrogate mother. Everything moved quite quickly at that point. I mean, the shipping of the embryos, all that took months, and because of paperwork and red tape, and both clinics had to match their freezing processes. They had to be doing the same lab technique. So we got our surrogate mother got pregnant, and yeah, the due date of that baby was 30th of November, which is mum's anniversary.
You're kidding me.
Yeah. The whole way along, no change to, he just stayed the same, always 30th of November. So we went to Ukraine. We had about 4 or 5 days before he arrived. We didn't know when he was going to arrive, obviously, but we were giving ourselves time. We were easier. We had time to go over, just get to know the area, meet her, go to appointments. And yeah, he came the 27th.
What was it like seeing, you know, your baby being carried? How was that experience for you? Were you relieved?
I was so relieved when we decided on surrogacy, and that I was like, I don't have to put my body through that anymore because it won't be able for it. But also it was really hard that I couldn't do it and that somebody else was doing it for us. And I didn't get to go into the scans and to go into this and to have the feeling of being pregnant. And but I very quickly came to terms with that. And I was like, no, this is unbelievable. It was this or nothing.
Yeah.
Like, and I wasn't able to deal with the fact that maybe we wouldn't have children. I was like, no, there has to be a way. There has to be a way. And it was absolutely amazing. Like, unbelievable. And yeah, Jude was born 27th of November.
Tell me about the moment that he was handed to you.
I actually can't, like, I can't even describe, like, I just couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. Like, there were no, I don't even, you know, it was just a total miracle. Like, the most precious thing that I'd ever been handed. Like, you know. And he was, oh, he's just the best little boy. He is just, yeah. And, you know, throughout all that, I was like, that was Mum helping me. She helped me through the sepsis. And she had acknowledged before, she said, did you see that couple on such and such that went through surrogacy? That's very interesting, isn't it? You know, and I feel like that was her way of saying, if this is the route you have to go down, that's what you have to do.
She was nudging.
So I had her blessing. So we came home to Ireland on the day of the toy show. So it was, the toy show was just to us, it's like good and bad.
It's full circle, isn't it?
Yeah, it was like the day Mum went into hospital, but also the day Jew came home. We arrived into Dublin Airport to banners and screams and...
From your family?
From our family.
Oh, stop, no. Now I'm gone.
And then I got home with Jude, and there was the other half of the family who couldn't make it to the airport, and they had decorated the house for Christmas, and they had Sally at home. She had been minded by someone, and lights on, doors open. Oh my God, it was unbelievable. Like, it was, I just can't, that feeling was just, I can't describe it. It was a whirlwind of emotions.
Yeah. What a story. My goodness. He's 11 weeks old now.
No, he is 14 months old.
He's 14 months.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, I know. I know, I'm like going. So we had sent two embryos over, thinking we'll be lucky if one works, because I had had embryo transfers before, they hadn't worked, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
so you sent the
two. I was like, these are the same embryos, like, are they going to work? So we sent two. Jude was one, and then we're like, never thought we'd do a sibling journey, because already it's massive what we did. But then we're like, we can't leave that embryo that one became Jude. Like, what?
We can't just leave it.
We have to try it. If it doesn't work, fine, we have a gorgeous little boy and we've gone through a lot. So sooner than we would have planned, we were kind of like, I was like, we'll just sign the paperwork, we'll have it done so that when we come to deciding, that's done. But everything happened so quickly, and they were like, we have this really great surrogate mother, we think you'd really like her, you know, do you want, are you, and we were like, okay, we'll just, there is, I won't talk about it, but there is legislation that might make commercial surrogacy in the future quite difficult. So that was kind of in the back of my head as well. So we were like, okay, we'll go for it. And
how old was Jude at this point?
Jude was like 2 months. Yeah. I honestly see why you went for it.
But.
Yeah. We honestly were like going, there's no way. And as well, it's awful, but they grade embryos. And
yes,
this embryo wasn't as, and I know they say ignore the grading, but this embryo wasn't as good as the first embryo. So we were like, we just have to try it. And it's not like you put all your investment into it. You know, there's, things are done in installments. So it was a matter of trying. And yeah, so we got pregnant, our surrogate mother got pregnant. And we were like, oh my God. So yeah, Edith arrived 31st of October gone by.
Oh my God.
So 11 months between them.
Oh my God. Tell me about the moment your little girl was put in your arms.
Like, I honestly was like going, I feel guilty. At this point, I feel guilty for being so lucky. Because I'm like, how, like, she's perfect. And Jude's perfect. And like, something has to go wrong. I'm still waiting for something now to go wrong. Because, you know, it all, like, everything about it was amazing. And she's amazing. And Judah's a very good little baby. I was waiting for, we call her Edie, for her to be like little terror. Because I was like, surely the two of them won't be. And she's just a little angel.
Wow.
So, and my brother also had a little girl at the same time as Jude. So yeah, there's three grandchildren that Mum hasn't met. And I think Christmas this year, Dad found Christmas just gone by really difficult. And I think it's because of the start of the next generation and not having seen any of them.
Yeah, Mum has missed out on it. But perhaps sent them all.
I think sent them all, yeah.
What a gorgeous ending. Bittersweet, but it's, God, it's so lovely to hear that. And, you know, surrogacy is something I've never spoke about here. And I wish we'd more time to kind of get into it.
Yeah, really. There's so much to talk about with surrogacy.
It's so important because there's a lot of people tuning in that are at the stage that you were at.
Yeah.
With the miscarriages and struggling to get pregnant. There's huge grief around that. It's loss. So maybe just to dwell on that for a moment before we finish. Surrogacy is something that you probably never thought you were going down the road
never.
Of in a million years.
No, even, you know, you do those marriage courses before you get married and they say things like, if you have to go down the route of assisted fertility or whatever, I was like, we won't have to be doing that. You know, that was, and sure, I did that. We did that, plenty of that, loads of ovulation induction, loads of IVF. So surrogacy was never. Now, what was funny was when mum said to me, when she was following somebody's journey, she took such interest in it. And I was like, going, God, I'm going through fertility struggles, but I'd never end up having to do surrogacy.
Isn't it funny? Because I do think there is a bit of a hesitation.
Hmm.
And it's always the last resort. And I understand why.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, you want, you know, because there is a loss there, as you touched on. And I'm glad that you said that, because I do imagine that is a part of what you go through is, I didn't get to carry my baby. I didn't get to feel the kicks. I didn't get to deliver or give birth to my babies that I have here now with me. You are very much a mom to Matthew as well. You gave birth and brought him into the world. And so there is such a loss, and it's so different. It's what you want in an ideal situation, but the world doesn't work like that. Nothing is ideal. Yeah. So for you, do you really feel like you are an advocate for surrogacy now to bring your babies to you?
Totally. There's so many people that I see that have gotten in touch with me since they know, and they, like me, were like, I didn't know this was an option first. I thought this was something that, you know, was totally out of our reach. And they could be in Ireland spending thousands upon thousands upon thousands on IVF. And their mental health is just like going absolutely, just going downhill, which was the way mine was going. Like, I'll be totally honest, I was really struggling to just do anything because I was like, this is debilitating. But like, so many people have gotten in touch with me, like, you don't know me, but can I just ask you, you know, and it's so nice to be able to say all the positive things about surrogacy. Like, the experience I had was unbelievable. Really, really unbelievable. Now, I know there's some, you know, there's definitely opinions from people, and you're always conscious of who you're talking to and what they believe surrogacy is. You know, the older generation definitely kind of think it's a bit of, is that adoption or what's that? Do you go and collect the baby and this type of thing?
Mm.
So I'd always, in our case, it was, you know, our embryos.
It's your baby.
It was our baby fully. And, you know, some people do have to use donor and, you know, but for us, we literally, our baby and somebody amazingly carried Jude and Edie for us.
Yeah.
And they're amazing people. And
do you still keep in contact?
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah. Every, like, just kind of birthdays or a big, you know, Christmas or things like that. And it's really nice. I know some people maybe choose not to, but I very much feel like they're the reason that Jude and Edie are here. I need to be able to contact them if I need to.
Yeah.
And just show them what a happy life we are having because of them. Like, the Edie's, on the last day I saw her, she was like, it just makes me so happy to see you so happy. You know, I was just like, she's such a nice person.
Mm. That's amazing. I'm so happy for you.
Thank you.
Surrogacy is amazing.
That's absolutely incredible.
I would know Brian and Arthur and Aoife.
Yeah.
That story is.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful.
It's incredible, yeah.
It's one of the most incredible things. And it's a miracle, as you say.
I totally feel lucky, really, really lucky that it became something we thought about and something we did and something we'll forever be paying for. But, you know, whatever. I don't care. I don't care.
You might be shouting that at them under 21. Do you realise all the money we spent to get you here?
Yeah, for sure.
No.
But yeah, nothing like that matters to me anymore. Like, I don't care. We'll figure things out.
I'm so happy for you. You'll have to show me a picture when we hang up here.
Yeah. I will for sure.
Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story, because it has so many twists and turns, so many ups and downs, so many scary moments. And wow, you're so young and all of this has happened. But I just feel like right now in this moment, it sounds very happy and also bittersweet with mom always there in the background.
Yeah.
Dad, and look, I wish you nothing but the best
going forward
for you and your wonderful family that's surrounding you.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.